Welcome to the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast, a view of culture, current events, and politics through a biblical lens, with your hosts, Neil Boron, Bob Duco, Roger Marsh, and John Rush. Now let's join the conversation.
Happy to be back with you folks for another week of the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast with Neil and Roger and John and myself, Bob. Guys, how are you?
Good, Bob.
Doing great. Well. Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Well, this week, all eyes seem to be on Kenosha, Wisconsin, and of course the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. Just so you folks know, we're recording this on Wednesday morning. And so as of this morning, Wednesday morning, we don't have a verdict yet in the trial. The jurors yesterday, they couldn't come to a conclusion. They requested some more information from the judge, and they were dismissed last night. They have resumed their deliberations today. So it is possible a decision could end up coming down later today after this podcast. So we're going to talk about this, at least from the perspective of what we know now. The whole country is kind of holding their breath, hoping and praying that there's not going to be any kind of riots that break out. I do think, and I know this is a political commentary, but I do believe that if he's found guilty, there's not going to be riots from a bunch of conservatives who think that was injustice. But if he's acquitted, there's a very real danger and risk of potential riots breaking out in this country. And certainly we hope and pray that that would not be the case. So what we're going to do, the four of us, is we're going to take this hour and pretty much have a roundtable discussion about this entire case from beginning to end through the trial. Was it self-defense? Was it not? Should he have been there? Should he not have been there? How should we as believers and as Americans process this whole case, this whole trial? So let me just say, first of all, I want to kind of throw out some of my thoughts, and we're very open to the possibility that there may be some disagreements in how some of us view what's going on. So guys, let me just kind of throw my cards on the table here, and then I'd love to go around the table. When I look at Kyle Rittenhouse, this 17-year-old kid, do I think he's perfect? No, of course not. Nobody's claiming that. But I do have to admit that I have found myself warming up to him more the more that I learn about this entire thing. Yes, there's a bunch of people who say he shouldn't have been there in the first place. Why was he even there in the first place? And I always find it interesting that those who say that never seem to say that about the rioters. They never seem to say, why was Rosenbaum there? Okay, why were all of the rioters there? No, it's just Rittenhouse is the bad guy for going there. But I think to myself, wait a minute, he's 17 years old. Here's a 17-year-old kid who goes to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and some say, well, why did he travel across state lines? He only lives 17 miles, okay, from Kenosha, his mom's house. And Kenosha is where the rest of his family lives. His dad lives in Kenosha, as does his grandmother and his aunt and his uncle and his cousin. So he's very familiar with Kenosha. That's kind of his second hometown, if you will. You had a couple of days of riots that have gone on already in Kenosha. The buildings are being burned down. We've already had in Kenosha, by this point, there were 100 buildings just damaged, over 40 buildings destroyed, $50 million estimated in damages. So he decides, I'm going to go to Kenosha and try to help out in the community. So what does he do? He takes a first aid bag because he does know first aid. He's a lifeguard to provide any medical care to people that might need it. He also joins volunteer teams to help clean graffiti off of walls. And there's pictures of him doing that as well. He also says, I want to protect a local business, a car dealership. And of course, since it's a dangerous place, he arms himself. He has an AR-15 with him, which it was legal for him to have, as the prosecutor confirmed to the judge before that particular charge was dropped. So when he's there, you can see in the video, he's not an aggressor. He's not chasing after anybody. He's not pointing the gun at people. He's not doing anything like that at all. You get these guys that start approaching him, coming after him. What does he do? Rather than turning the gun on them, he takes off running, and he takes off running in the direction of the police station. Before that even happened, there's a video of a police officer standing there talking to Kyle Rittenhouse, and the police officer says, we really appreciate you guys being here. We really appreciate it. I really mean that. Okay, he's on camera saying this. So here's a kid. He takes off running when the bad guys are pursuing him. But one of the guys is faster than Rittenhouse, catches up to him, starts trying to wrestle his gun away from him while saying, "I'm going to kill you." So Rittenhouse fires his gun. That guy dies. He then continues running toward the police station, and the other two guys catch up to him. One of them knocks him to the ground. The other guy gets his skateboard and starts beating him in the head with the skateboard while he's on his back. This is something you can die from. He shoots that guy with his gun. The other guy pulls out his loaded gun and points it at Kyle Rittenhouse's face, and Rittenhouse shoots that guy. That guy survives and testified to this fact in the trial. And then Rittenhouse, when it's all done, goes to the police, turns himself in, and says, "Here's what happened." So I got to tell you, folks, to me, I'm having a hard time seeing how anybody can claim this was not self-defense. And I'm also not on the bandwagon of attacking him, saying, "Well, he shouldn't have gone in the first place." I mean, it's a fair debate to have. Was it wise or not wise to go there? But I don't think it's fair to undo the self-defense nature of this, even if you believe that it was unwise for him to go there. I'm thinking that's a pretty brave 17-year-old kid who wants to help the community clean graffiti, take first aid kit, not attack or be an aggressor toward anybody, but try to protect businesses from burning down. And then when you're pursued and somebody yells they're going to kill you, rather than turning on them, you take off running to try to get to safety, even though you've got a gun you could use, and he wasn't using it at that time. I look at all of that, and to me, that mitigates the hatred that some people have built up for Kyle Rittenhouse. Now, that's just me throwing my cards on the table, and I'm very open to the possibility that I'm looking at stuff wrong. And so let's kind of talk about this a little bit now, if we could, and kind of go around the table. And maybe, John, we could start with you. Of course, John Rush, Rush to Reason from Denver, Colorado. Your 35,000-view take on everything surrounding this case, and I know we'll get into some of the details and minutia of it as we go along, but some of your immediate overview observations.
Well, and I appreciate your perspective as well, Bob. I'm not much different than you on all of this. It doesn't really matter whether he made a bad call in being there or not. That's not the issue. We live in a free country. He's got the ability to go anywhere he wants at any given time that he wants. The rest of us do as well. And I think we really get into dangerous ground, even as, you know, Christians and conservatives, and we say, well, you know, he made a bad choice. He shouldn't have been there. You know, I would have done it differently. Well, you know, that's not the point. We're talking about the law, and can you defend yourself? I think the other risk we run with all of this that I want to get into today, guys, and you heard the prosecutor talk about this, and I think it's a very, very dangerous ground to get to, which the prosecutor makes it sound like you cannot defend your property in this country any longer. Like, it's just willy-nilly, anybody can come along, steal, pillage, rape, burn, do whatever they want to, and you can't defend yourself unless your life is threatened in the process, which, by the way, is total garbage. You know, we still live in a country where there's a rule of law, and you should be able to, and last time I checked, you could protect yourself from anyone else trying to harm you or your personal property, and that doesn't need to change. Now, would I have done things differently had I been him? I'm not him. I can't answer that. I won't answer that. The reality is he has a right to defend himself. He did, and in my opinion, he's innocent.
Don't forget, the prosecutor actually said you lose your right to self-defense if you have a gun.
Which is a bunch of garbage.
Yeah, tell that to everybody who has a
total
concealed
garbage.
Carry license. So if you have a concealed carry license and you have a gun and somebody's attacking you with a hammer, you lose your right to self-defense because you have a gun? What are you kidding me?
Yeah, this guy is the epitome of what the left and the communists basically that want to run this country believe in. And if they had their way about it, everybody would be disarmed. The only body allowed to be on the streets in a situation like that would be the rioters and protesters, the folks that are burning things to the ground. Again, my fear, guys, is that a precedence is being set to where folks, you know, business owners even, cannot defend themselves and their own property, which is a bunch of garbage.
All right, let's take a break, and we want to hear from Roger and Neil on this. We'll continue this National Crawford Roundtable next.
Be transformed by the Word of God with Alistair Begg in Truth for Life. Every weekday, Alistair Begg teaches the Bible through in-depth verse-by-verse attention to the Word of God. You can listen to Truth for Life on your local Crawford Broadcasting Station or listen online at truthforlife.org. Please support this important ministry with your donations at the truthforlife.org website or by calling 888-588-7884, and be sure to let them know you heard about Truth for Life from the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast.
Continuing the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast with John Rush, Rush to Reason out of Denver, Colorado, Roger Marsh of The Bottom Line from the People's Republic of California, Neil Boron of Neil Boron Live from Buffalo, New York, myself, Bob Duco out of Detroit. We're talking about the whole Kyle Rittenhouse case, and keep in mind, we are broadcasting this. We're recording this on Wednesday morning, so as of this recording, the verdict has not come in, so we don't know yet what the verdict is in this case as we discuss this. Roger Marsh, let me go to you. Of course, your take, or kind of getting some overview perspectives on this and perceptions of this whole thing before we start diving into some of the actual individual details. But what are some of your takeaway thoughts when you look at this case, Kyle Rittenhouse, and everything that's happened to this point?
Well, there was so much unrest going on in the country at the time of the riots. And the context, of course, for all this, I think, is really important. Because if we look at letter of the law, does Kyle Rittenhouse have the right to, you know, be in possession of a gun? Yes, he does. Was he doing something very noble, cleaning graffiti? Absolutely. I mean, you know, on paper, you can make a very, very compelling case for Kyle Rittenhouse. I try to think like a prosecuting attorney, saying, okay, well, if I'm trying to try this case, what would I, you know, what angle would I take? Understand, this is what, the third day of the Jacob Blake riots that were happening in Kenosha. Mm-hmm. And this was, it was that summer, you know, where we had George Floyd, we had Ahmaud Arbery, you know, Breonna Taylor, I mean, all those different cases. And the tensions were high, no question about it. I think it's very admirable for a young guy to say, hey, look, I want to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. So I'm going to go and I'm going to clean graffiti and I'm going to go and, you know, stand watch with the police and I'm going to do that stuff. And I think that's all very noble and admirable for him to do. I think the question that a lot of people are asking, you know, is answered legally by saying, well, why did he have a gun and why was he there in the first place? You can certainly make the case. And in terms of the state line issue and things like that, I completely get that too, because here in the People's Republic, you know, we're 900 miles from, you know, state line to state line, so it's kind of hard to think in terms of, I'm glad I'm a baseball fan, so I understand, oh yeah, Wisconsin isn't that far from Illinois, isn't that far from Indiana, or what, you know, the whole Great Lakes region. When I look at, you know, the facts in the case and the kind of, I know we're going to get into the circus element of the trial, because the prosecution has just been kind of a clown car. I mean, I think that's being kind in terms of the way that typically happens. In terms of guilt or innocence, I'm looking at context first and foremost. And the question that I kind of get stuck on, and again, I'm not saying that I'm in favor of his, you know, innocence or that he should be proven guilty, but I understand the need to want to go and protect and serve and to stand alongside the police. The question I'm sure a lot of people are asking is, in the light of the reason why people were rioting and protesting, and I realize some people were doing so, you know, from an altruistic standpoint, and other people were doing it because we know there are agitators that get paid to show up and, you know, cause a scene and make things work. Aren't they still rioting in Portland? Does anybody even know why they are? I mean, it's been going on for a year and a half there. But in this case, I think that the question that the media narrative that has to be addressed is, white kid with a gun shoots people. Okay, obviously he didn't kill black people, so I mean that you take the race component out of it. But how come it's okay for a white kid to bring an AR-15, you know, to the deal, which we all know stands for Armalite? It doesn't stand for assault rifle. I don't know why the media keeps playing that. You know, he brought an assault weapon to the. No, he didn't.
Popular rifle in America.
Right.
Okay? I mean, half the people there with rifles had AR-15.
Exactly. Exactly. I think you could probably make a very compelling case. He did not go there to hurt anyone. And as you watch the timeline, if you look at the drone video, you can see this all play out. But I know Jacob Blake's mother, Julia Jackson, gave a really impassioned speech. She's a godly woman. Her pastor, James E. Ward Jr., is a friend of mine. I had James on the program right after, in the aftermath of all this. And Jacob, I'm pleased to report, is actually making a recovery from his injuries and is actually given his life to the Lord, which is fantastic.
Oh, I mean,
it's
really great.
It's a remarkable story. But when you think about, you know, the way the narrative gets played out, the media leaves everything frozen in time on that day. White kid has a gun, shoots people, people are dead, and they were at the protest for the black person, so obviously he's a white supremacist. And I mean, that these are just, you know, reactions to this in terms of trying to piece this all together. I think he's going to be acquitted, but I in terms of the national conversation, I think we've got a lot more conversing to do rather than just saying, hey, it's Second Amendment, you've got a right to defend the business and whatever, because the context of where, why he was there in the first place, I think is something we don't want to overlook.
Absolutely. Which, by the way, Jacob Blake, he gave his life to the Lord. That's fantastic. Is he getting any feeling in his legs? Do you know?
I don't know. I know that, you know, the recovery is slow, and you know, right. It's one of those things. But he had been, Julia, his mom, was part of a prayer team at James Ward's church in Illinois, and trust me, Jacob was top of the list. I mean, you know, they'd been praying for that guy for a long time, and so the idea that, you know, bad guy. I mean, everything he was doing. Yes, he was violating a TRO. Yes, he was reaching for a knife. I mean, those are the facts that often get, you know, right, brushed aside in a case like this. But the reality is, I mean, he didn't lose his life. He has, you know, committed himself to Christ, as far as last of my conversation with James a month or so ago. And there is a positive, you know, story that's coming out of that for a change. Sure. But the media has no interest in that, of course, because the media narrative is, you know, cops shoot black guy in the back and, you know, there we go again. And for every case that does happen like this, I mean, this case could be a very pivotal turning point in terms of, you know, all sorts of different relations that need to be mended and healed. So I'm watching this case and hoping that, I'm glad that we're having this conversation today. I'm hoping that our discussion will shed some light on every aspect of this, so it doesn't just become a wrap yourself in the flag and Second Amendment and, you know, that type of stuff. Because legally we can solve it, but I think the greater impact, you know, from a faith perspective is, you know, the letter of the law is written to protect or prosecute or persecute, you know, depending on who's in power, you know, when you get right down to it. We know ultimately God's law is just and pure, and we know that if we follow that, ultimately he's judge and jury. I mean, we're playing the long game for eternity as opposed to the, did I get a big win on TV, you know, case, which we're kind of, which the media plays all the time in this country.
Well, that's true. Neil Boron Live, Buffalo, New York. Neil, what's your initial kind of overview of this particular case?
Well, to kill a overused cliche, it is what it is. Like, I don't really have much to say about anything that you guys are talking about, because your opinions are valid. And I think there's an awful lot of people in America right now forming opinions about what happened. A couple of things that I'll just say, you know, do I think he should have been there? That's an interesting question. Should have been there? There's another way to ask the question. Was it wrong for him to go? I mean, it depends which angle you want to take in looking at it. I mean, let me just say this. I think he's not a demon by any means. But I also would caution against, you know, conservatives making a hero out of him. Like, this is how we ought to handle things in the United States of America. I mean, he's not qualified, licensed law enforcement. So you could make the argument, like, so who put you in charge? Who put you there? He made a choice to go. And let's keep in mind, because I was a kid once and so were you guys, that the male brain isn't fully formed until about the age of 25. So at the age of 17, I mean, what immediately comes to mind is I remember playing paintball with my nephew Tyler one time and a whole bunch of other kids running around in the woods and the whole thing. And, you know, he was exceptional at the whole thing. I noticed at the end of the game, he wanted to debrief, you know, like he was real into the military aspect of paintball. Well, he went on to become an Army Ranger, served faithfully, doing many tours of duty, and today is a Black Hawk pilot. I mean, he went forward, he got training, he became what he thought he was when he was playing paintball. But when he was paintball, he wasn't an Army Ranger, and he wasn't qualified to be making huge decisions about people's lives and stuff. So I'm just saying that putting a 17-year-old kid in that, nobody put him there. He chose to go there, and apparently nobody stopped him. But, you know, he went there with altruistic motives. But, like, you're walking into a rat's nest, and if you walk into a rat's nest and think you're not going to get the bubonic plague, you got another thing coming. Like, it was, you're right, Roger mentioned it earlier, that these riots were going on. They had been for a while. It was the summer of love, right? I mean, they were looting, burning, and nobody who has a brain in their head is comfortable with that kind of thing. So in one sense, we see him as a hero. And thank God he didn't get killed. Let's remember there were other people with guns, and many of them were fired during that whole thing. How Kyle Rittenhouse isn't dead remains to be seen, but he could have tragically lost his life. The other thing is, and I'll just say this, I mean, the people that were killed, and I know that I think all of them had criminal, the two guys had criminal records, the other one shot as well had a criminal record. Skateboard man, no, I'm sorry, what's it called? Kick in the face man or whatever they're calling him. He had a criminal record. So, you know, these aren't like law-abiding model citizens that we're talking about. There were street thugs, you know, destroying Kenosha, Wisconsin. And I think Kyle Rittenhouse had a good heart. He wanted to go. He wanted to help. He wanted to be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. All those things are true. But, like, it is what it is. And it got really ugly. And people are dead as a result. Rittenhouse could have been dead as a result. I'm going to say I don't think it was wrong that he went. I'm just not sure it was wise. That's all.
Yeah. All right. And by the way, you talk about the criminal record. I mean, yeah, all three of these guys were convicted felons. One of them, Rosenbaum, one of the guys that died. This is a guy who spent 10 years in prison for forcible rape and sodomy of 9 to 11-year-old boys. Okay, I mean, these are some bad guys, all right? Does that mean they deserve to die? No, but if they're trying to kill someone and threatening someone's life, then they're bringing that self-defense death on themselves at that
point. And I'll disagree, Bob. When he did what he did to those young kids, in my book, yeah, good riddance.
Yeah. Well, sorry. Anyway, I mean, I get it. I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying.
I have no sympathy for those types of individuals. Now, if they, you know, come to Christ somehow, give themselves over to the Lord, ask forgiveness and so on, great. But in this guy's case, he did none of that. He's just, sorry, he's scum that inflicted his scum upon other people. Kyle did us a favor.
Let's take a short break, folks. We'll continue the podcast next.
Dr. James Dobson left a successful career in academia to preserve and promote the biblical family in America. The radio broadcasting ministry of Dr. Dobson spans over four decades, earning him 17 honorary doctorate degrees and an induction into the National Radio Hall of Fame. Today, Dr. Dobson continues to champion marriage and parenthood through Family Talk. Listen every weekday at drjamesdobson.org and be sure to reference the National Crawford Roundtable podcast when asked how you listen to Family Talk.
Continuing the National Crawford Roundtable podcast with Roger Marsh, John Rush, Neil Boron, myself, Bob Duco, talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse case. And actually, John, let me go to something that Neil was saying that, you know, should he have been there? We can't say. Was it wise to go? You know, did he have a right to be there? Yes. Was it wise for him to go? No. This is something I guess I was talking about this a little bit earlier here. I'm getting more and more sympathetic to Kyle Rittenhouse because I feel like if somebody wants to make the decision not to go, okay, fine. But here's a 17-year-old kid who says, look, that's where my family lives. It's 17 miles away.
Bob, he did what everybody else in the country on the conservative side, and I think even some liberals, wanted to do because they wanted that nonsense to end.
Yeah, in a sense of, you know what? No, I'm not going to cower. I'm not going to stand by and watch my family's city burn to the ground. No, I'm going to go there. I'm going to get involved. I'm not going to be stupid. I'm going to take a gun so that if I need to defend myself, I'm able to. But I'm going to stand guard with the police. I'm going to do that, and I'm going to be prepared to provide medical help if people need it. And on top of that, clean graffiti and such. So, and by the way, he was also a police explorer. Which is kind of like an apprentice working with police to potentially become one. And he was also a cadet with the local fire department. When I was 17 years old, it's like, what, are you kidding me? I was just learning to tie my shoes. So I think
the other thing, too, that you have to look at is when he entered things in the video and the pictures we see, he didn't enter that scene gun drawn, you know, blazing, ready to go. No, the thing was strapped around his back. You know, he had a sling. You know, it was slung around his back, and he was, to your point, going to do other things. It was there for his protection, which I guess everybody in this country forgets. The Second Amendment gives us the right to do that. That's what it's there for, folks. So anytime we start diminishing that, we're diminishing the Second Amendment and the ability for us as Americans to defend ourselves against foreign, domestic, terror, or our own government, for that matter.
And I got to remind everybody, too, and Roger, maybe get your take on this, too. If he was just there looking for trouble, then as soon as those guys started approaching him, started basically chasing toward him, he would have instantly pointed the gun at them, stood his ground, if you will, and either threatened them and or shot them. But he had a gun. He had the ability to stop them. And instead, he took off running. He took off running toward the police station. That tells me he was not looking for trouble, Roger, but he was prepared for trouble if he needed to use his gun.
Yeah, big difference between Tom Cruise and Sean Penn in the movie Taps, right? You know, I mean, when Cruise is up there with that, it's beautiful, baby!
It's beautiful, man!
Yeah, I'm just, but, I mean, not to make light of a tense situation,
movie.
But yeah, I mean, when you get right down to it, it really does come down to motives. And only, you know, this is a court of law. I mean, only God knows the heart of this kid. I mean, the case is being made, I think, very convincingly that he went altruistically, that he had some basic training in terms of, you know, the police apparatus, in terms of, you know, being a cadet and that type of thing, was taking the right position. And let's also give him, you know, hey, you're 17 years old, and when someone's chasing you with a gun, you're going to act, you know, somewhat irrationally. It's not a video game. But then wasn't that what the prosecution was trying to say? Well, you play Call of Duty, so doesn't that mean that you, you know.
That guy, by the way, what an utter jerk.
Oh, we're going to get into that in the second half. Well, I'll tell you what, as a matter of fact, I'm looking at the clock here. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour because we want to talk about the trial and the prosecutor and then some other aspects, obviously, of this as well. So there's many different parts of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and case to discuss. And remember, folks, we are recording this episode Wednesday morning. The verdict has not come in yet. Yeah. So,
which I don't know why that's taken so long. That's another, another conversation.
Which is, you're right. It is, John, because that's a little bit troubling as well. This, to me, seems so
cut
open
and dried.
And shut. If this is not self-defense, I don't know. How do you even define self-defense going forward at this point? But all right, we are coming up on the bottom of the hour. Folks, we encourage you, listen to the second half of this National Crawford Roundtable podcast online. You can do this by going to CrawfordMediaGroup.net or wherever you listen to podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and more. Tell your friends, and we always appreciate all the 5-star reviews that we get for the show. Thank you so much for that. And Neil and Roger and John and myself, we're going to be continuing this second half coming up next here on the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast.
This has been a Crawford Broadcasting production.
Continuing the second half of the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast with myself, Bob Duco, with John Rush of Rush to Reason from Denver, Colorado, Roger Marsh of The Bottom Line from California, the People's Republic, Neil Boron from Neil Boron Live of Buffalo, New York. We're talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse case. And Neil, I know a lot of people have been paying attention to this trial. I admit, I have not been absorbed in the trial. I haven't been watching it. I haven't watched not 1 minute of the trial live. I've watched excerpts on video from it as I kind of prepare for my show, but it hasn't captured me the way that we'll say the O.J. Simpson trial did back when or whatever, but it's captured a lot of people in this country, and it does seem like there's been a lot of theatrics going on in this thing. Like, for example, we're going to talk about this prosecutor now. The prosecutor takes an AR-15 and points it at the jury.
What a knucklehead.
In an effort. And I know what his thinking was most likely this, that let me put the jury in the position of the guys who got shot so that they will see how horrible it is for somebody to point an AR-15 at them, and maybe they'll transfer that uncomfortable feeling to Kyle Rittenhouse. But it's like, are you kidding? And this is in light of the Alec Baldwin shooting that took place, even though, yes, the prosecutor said to his assistant, hey, make sure it's unloaded. But it's like, are you kidding me? You do that in a courtroom after the Alec Baldwin thing? And so he's got that, and then the absurdity of saying you lose your self-defense rights if you have a gun. Oh, and on top of that, Kyle Rittenhouse is a coward because, you know, everybody takes a beating sometimes. He should have just let himself take – so he should have let the skateboard keep pounding his head. You know, everybody – he was too cowardly to use his fists. Oh, a 17-year-old kid against three older guys coming at him, he's too cowardly, he should have used his fists. And then referring to the thugs that were there as, quote, heroes. I mean, Neil, first, I'd love to get your take. I don't know if you were paying attention to any of the trial at all, but for the prosecutor to be saying stuff like that, it seems like a Saturday Night Live skit.
Well, exactly. And it's probably going to show up on Saturday Night Live this weekend. How you make a joke out of the whole thing, I don't know, but you wait and see. There's going to be something about it. But yeah, I mean, it's reprehensible. The one guy, I think his name was James Krause, interestingly, Tucker Carlson referred to him as Tubby, but
Carlson had some great analysis on this last night. I don't know if
good
you saw his commentary,
Lord,
but
yeah, I saw
it was unbelievable. Dead on. But anyway, go ahead.
But you know, all the stuff that they were pushing, everything you just outlined, Bob, is all part of this liberal narrative that, like, we're in charge now. You know, we're the mob. You have to listen to us. We call the shots. Government's bad. Orange man bad, conservatives bad, pro-lifers bad, whatever, just fill in the blank. You know, we know better than you. It's the whole liberal progressive mentality that we've been dealing with for so many years now. And it's coming out of our, you know, major colleges and universities. All the institutions of higher learning are pushing this kind of baloney that we know best. And if you have any kind of conservative values or biblical values, you're wrong. You need to be done away with. You are the problem. And really, ultimately, that's what we were seeing coming out. It was just being spewed by Binger and Krause, both of those prosecution attorneys. I mean, the whole thing is an absolute circus. I think Roger called it a clown car. I'd call it a clown show. But either way, absolutely unbelievable that that kind of thing was going on in the courtroom. And one of the individuals I saw last night on one of the news shows actually said that charges ought to be brought against Thomas Binger for pointing an AR-15 at the jury. Like,
right.
How in the world can that happen in a civilized courtroom, supposedly? But anyhow, it did. And it's disgusting.
It is. Roger, you did reference it as a clown car. And it really was. But just some of your observations about the prosecutor, I mean, honestly, I think back to the O.J. Simpson trial, and there were really the prosecution and the defense team, I hate to say it, all of them on both sides were almost caricatures of themselves. But I look at this Binger guy, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This guy absolutely is a caricature.
He doesn't seem, and again, I'm not a lawyer. Obviously, we all know lawyers, and some of us may have legal backgrounds. But when it comes to prosecution, you have to have a case that's so airtight. And as I mentioned in the opening of on the broadcast side of the podcast here, a good attorney is going to look at and have the answer to the question before they ask the question, right? They're going to know how if you're the prosecution, you're going to know what the defense is going to do. You've played this chess game all the way out to find out who's going to get the checkmate, and you want the checkmate to be on your side. And the fact that these guys keep bringing up the things that they do, and Bruce Schroeder's winning Emmy Awards every day, you know, for all the different things he's saying behind the bench, because he has to keep course correcting these clowns. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, there is enough evidence to make a case here, and obviously he does need to stand trial so he can be, you know, either acquitted or, you know, convicted. But the way they're presenting their prosecution, you know, it keeps making the defense's job that much easier. I mean, it's mind-boggling to think that these guys, you might say, well, they didn't have enough time to prepare. I'm thrilled that this case actually came up as soon as it did, because oftentimes, different circumstances, different people, different backgrounds, this case might get backlogged. And Kyle Rittenhouse, if he were a different ethnicity, for example, he might still be sitting in jail for 5 years waiting for trial. You know, I mean, because they didn't want to bring it to light. So somebody made this sure that this got fast-tracked. Somebody made sure that this got in the court of public opinion. The only problem is the prosecution is just whiffing left and right on whatever kind of evidence they might even have to make a case. And it's making the defense's job a lot easier. And it is, making it easier for the American public to look at this and say, well, oh, okay, this guy was a police cadet. And, oh, that's why he had the weapon. And he went down there to clean graffiti and he was standing in front of the thing. There's chaos going on. So now it's a whole different scenario. And meanwhile, this guy comes out here and all of a sudden it's injustice for all, right? You know, there's Al Pacino. You're out of order. is that they're screaming and yelling at each other and waving weapons in the courtroom just to try to prove a point. We know what the gun looks like. We know what, you know, it could potentially happen here. And you don't try to prove a guy guilty of shooting somebody who had a gun to your head by putting a gun to the head of the jury and saying, "See how it feels?" I mean, that's it's just incredible.
It is hard to believe. John, your take on this prosecutor and the way that he's handled this, which, by the way, Roger made an excellent point here, John, that law school 101,
right.
You never ask a question unless you know what the answer is going to be, and right. Then your rebuttal. It's playing chess 10 moves at a time. But for him to be caught by surprise with the guy, the Gage guy, saying that, I pointed the gun at him first before I was shot. And then what do you know? I guess that gun really was of legal length after all. So, mm-hmm. Okay, that case gets
dropped. Or why were you in Kenosha? Well, my father lives there. I mean, so many, we can go down
what
the list.
Great aunt. What a great
we can go down the list.
Never mind.
Bob, of the things this guy, I mean, this guy is a clown. If, frankly, somebody needs to be moving to disbar this guy when this is all said and done. Because if this is the best they can do in that area for prosecutors, they've got real problems.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Major. This guy's a clown. Total clown.
He really is.
And on top of that, he knows he's on, you know, national television. Let's say that, you know, that people around the world, literally worldwide, are going to be watching what this guy's doing. And he continues to give out false information on the law over and over and over again. Again, that's why this guy needs disbarred. He should never be allowed to practice law ever again, period.
All right. I'll tell you what, I could not agree more. There comes a point where, especially if you're a prosecutor, you have the power.
You're supposed to know better.
Yeah. You're the one who brings indictments against people and puts them on trial, and you're the one making the case. And you're right. Actually stating things that are not the law, rewriting the law for the sake of the jury and for the hope of convincing the jury about something that's not true. The guy went full MSNBC with the jury, and it's like, no, you're the prosecutor. We understand you're trying to get a conviction here, but you can't lie about what the law is and the kind of
For example, the fact that you just because you have a gun, you can't defend yourself. That's not the law, pal. That's not what it says.
Right, exactly. A short break. We'll pick it up from there next on the National Crawford Roundtable.
Learn how to walk the narrow path with Steve Gregg. With over 40 years of studying the Bible, Steve Gregg is passionate about teaching you how to apply scriptural wisdom to every aspect of your life. Listen to The Narrow Path on your local Crawford broadcasting station or online at thenarrowpath.com. The Narrow Path is 100% listener supported. Please keep this vital ministry going with your generous financial support. And let them know you heard about The Narrow Path on the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast.
Continuing this National Crawford Roundtable Podcast, myself, Bob Duco, Roger Marsh, Neil Boron, John Rush, talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse case. What about the racial component to this, guys? Roger, I want to get your take on this. It does seem as though there is an unnecessary and a forced racial component to this, because Kyle Rittenhouse is white. The three guys that he shot were white. But it seems like race is being injected into this because, after all, he showed up at protest rioting, and since it was Black Lives Matter that was there, he's kind of taken an anti-Black Lives Matter stance. Add to that, looks like he was a Trump supporter. Well, then, therefore, he's automatically a racist. So somehow, some way, a white guy shoots three white guys, and this gets turned into a white versus black thing. It's really unfortunate, but unfortunately, if he's acquitted, I have a bad feeling there could be race riots as a result of this, race riots from a white guy shooting three white guys in self-defense.
Yeah, and I think that would circle back around to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the context of why Kyle Rittenhouse was there in the first place. There were protests over Jacob Blake being shot in the back by police officers, and never mind the fact that he had a temporary restraining order, shouldn't have been at the place in the first place, that he was, in fact, disobeying the police officers. He'd shot out, he'd fought through the taser. He was reaching for a knife. Now, obviously, they had guns and he had a knife, so, you know, who's going to win that argument? But nonetheless, and in the context of everything that's going on, there are people who would say, yeah, if Kyle Rittenhouse, change the narrative here. Let's make Kyle Rittenhouse Hispanic. Let's make him African American. Whatever. It doesn't matter who he shoots. Now they're going to hang him from the highest tree because he was there and there was protesting and he had a gun and he shot and killed three people. Case closed. In the court of public opinion, that's how it would play out. So yeah, I believe there are going to be a lot of folks who, when they hear the verdict, are going to say, that's not right, that's not fair, that's not justice, because they're not going to look specifically at the specifics of the case. They're going to look at the overall larger narrative, which was, well, if this had been somebody else, you know, why did he bring a gun in the first place? You can make a compelling case. It's still not going to set right with people. And I'm not trying to sound like a defeatist or a, you know, Debbie Downer here, but the reality is there are going to be some people for whom it doesn't matter what the verdict is, they're going to be upset. And so I think that's what the authorities are trying to prepare for. And I have a feeling, quite frankly, guys, that's part of the reason why there's hung up deliberation in the jury right now, is the fact that they're looking at this and saying, okay, we've got the evidence on the one hand, but we've also got some damage control to do. If we do come back with a verdict, whatever the verdict is, unanimously innocent, unanimously guilty, whatever it is, all hell's going to break loose again, and we don't want to be responsible.
And by the way, not their job. That should not even be in the consideration at all.
I 100% agree
with
you,
but that's not the way this works.
Yeah.
Right, and I agree with you. I mean, that's not the way it works, not the way it should work, but there's always that possibility, and I think that's where we are in America on the verge of 2022, is juries making decisions that say, well,
I think these guys, on top of that, Roger, fear their own life. I mean, that's the other problem we've got with
it's
all
mob
this.
Rule. Yeah. The mob and the mob wins, because the mob is controlling now the justice system in America, guys, where juries can be intimidated. This jury isn't sequestered. They can see what's going on in the news, and they can see that the force is amassing outside the courthouse just waiting for how this thing comes down, and so I understand the human element of, you know, they're at home and they're thinking, oh boy, you know, if I vote to acquit, then, you know, yes, all hell's going to break loose and me and my family could be targeted. And so you can't rule out that there's going to be somebody on the jury that's like, well, I think the guy's innocent, but I'm going to stick to my guns and go guilty because I'm just afraid for my family. That's a human nature thing.
And I'm guessing that's part of the deliberation process right now, I believe.
Right, and it goes – I believe it too. They're probably talking about – let's realistically discuss the ramifications of this. It's like, that's not what it ought to be. It takes real courage to be a juror now in a case like this. You have to exercise so much courage to go against the grain of the threats against your family and the community and everything else. And this is just it's the mob
controlling
the judicial system.
Somebody called in my show yesterday, and I did have to chuckle at this, but got to remember, the current jury, these are people that weren't smart enough to get out of jury duty.
Ow.
Yikes.
Ba-dum-bum.
I gotta tell this quick anecdote. Jury. By the way, has anybody here actually sat on a jury through the trial?
Been a foreman.
Have you really?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. So talk about not being smart enough to get out of it.
I tried my best that day too, and it didn't work. Trust me.
I've always been able to get out of jury duty, but I got a quick anecdote. Closest I ever came to jury duty was a couple of years ago, and there was this trial. This guy, a drug dealing and whatever, and so I'm there and I'm called, and sure enough, I'm juror number one that they call up there. So they got 12 of us seated up there, and so they start questioning us, right? And the defense attorney and the prosecuting, but nobody's asked me a question yet. So it's like, all right. So then the judge says to me, "If the evidence against the defendant was compelling and strong, could you vote to convict?" And I said, well, I don't know. I don't know what the evidence is. And so the judge said, okay, let's say there were 5 pieces of evidence brought against the defendant, and 4 of those pieces of evidence were compelling, but one of them was not. Would you convict? And I said, well, first, are we talking about preponderance of evidence, or are we talking about beyond reasonable doubt? She says, preponderance of evidence. I said, okay, I still can't answer your question because I need more factual information, like what is the weight of those 4 that were proven versus the weight of the one that was not proven? I said, I need to give them weight in the context of the case itself and weigh them against each other. I said, so in all honesty, Your Honor, not meaning to be problematic, but I don't have enough factual information to form an opinion to answer your question. As soon as I said that, the defense attorney stood up and said, I'd like to dismiss without cause.
Right. This guy's
and
gone.
The defense attorney just, this guy's gone. You know, and I'm sitting there and I got a smile and the prosecutor and I looked at each other and I smiled and it kind of had a knowing look of like, okay, the defense attorney knows his defendant's guilty and I'm not the guy he wants on the jury, you know? And so, but hey, look, it got me out of it. Bottom line. Yep. So, you know, do what you got to do. It does seem though, and Neil, I'd love to get your take on this as well. The racial component that seems to be coming into play here and the concern over race riots that could end up developing if he's acquitted. And I guess it really is troubling for me to think about the fact that this kid may be found guilty. And if he's found guilty, it's not going to be based on the evidence. It's going to be based on, okay, as a jury, let's decide we're not going to be responsible for cities burning down across the country and we're afraid of for the lives of our, you know, our own family members. That, I mean, I understand the human element of that, but my goodness, is that the judicial system now in this country from mobs that can intimidate from a distance?
Well, apparently it's not only the judicial system and the media who has been walking in lockstep with this whole thing, but apparently a whole bunch of the American people feel the same way. I don't, but you know, I'll recall a story here that I may have told previously on the podcast, but I was at Madison Square Garden in 92 covering the Democratic Convention. It was the Beefcake Brothers, Clinton and whatever his name was. Gore. Clinton and Gore.
Gore. Running,
they were, you know, running for president and vice president.
Was that after he invented the internet or before?
It was around the same time, actually.
Just making sure.
This guy sitting next to me, he's a major talk show host out of Southern California. I'm sure that Roger would know who he is if I said his name, but I'm not going to say it. But anyway, he brings up this issue of the OJ thing, which had happened years before. And somehow they were talking about this very same kind of issue. Like what should cause a jury to act? Is it merely the facts or is it the circus surrounding the facts? Or, you know, what should cause a jury to vote a certain way? So he said, hey, I want to hear only from African-American people right now. I want to hear only from black people. Because he said, I've heard more and more people say that OJ should have been freed simply because of slavery in the United States and because of, you know, the Jim Crow laws and because of the way blacks have been treated over the years. Some people were saying that OJ should have been freed simply to make good on all of that, like as a reparation, so to speak. And then I sat there. I was preparing for my own thing I was doing, but I was listening to his show and it was unbelievable. It was like 85% of the people that were calling his show were saying, absolutely, free OJ to help balance the scales of justice. And if you got that kind of thing going on here, in other words, it doesn't matter if Kyle Rittenhouse is innocent. Let's just convict him because it helps balance the scales of justice. Then we're in big trouble in this country. Decisions in courtrooms are supposed to be made upon the facts and the facts alone, not how many people are lined up outside the courtroom applying pressure. And you got to believe that is a major issue. These people are not unaware of the fact that there's, you know, National Guard assembling outside the building and fear for their lives. What happens if their name gets leaked as somebody who was one of the jurors that helped to free Kyle Rittenhouse? Literally, their lives are going to be in danger. And let me just add as well that even if Kyle Rittenhouse is acquitted, his life in many ways is going to be different. It won't be over, but it'll be very different. Like he's going to be the next Monica Lewinsky, so to speak. Like Monica Lewinsky, you know, for a variety of reasons, was dismissed as a real human being and only now is beginning to turn the corner on that. But I mean, she was viewed as a hussy and a whore and whatever she was viewed as. But, you know, apparently he's got PTSD. At least that's what one of the reports said, that he's already dealing with that. And how is his life not going to be in danger for the rest of his life? He's going to have to spend all of his time looking over his shoulder. It's a sad day, you know, when
he could also turn out to be very wealthy when this is all said and
done. That's right,
Neil.
That's right. I'm thinking this is like he's going to be like Sandman. The Covington High School kid,
yeah.
Nick Sandman.
Well,
you know,
maybe
he may have hundreds of millions of dollars to collect from the Washington Post and MSNBC.
Yeah, and he can count his money while he's in hiding because, you know, his life will be very different.
All right, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break. We'll pick it up from there next year on the National Crawford Roundtable.
Dr. Michael Youssef leads the way for people living in spiritual darkness to discover the light of Jesus Christ. This tremendous outreach begins with the proclamation of God's Word through the uncompromising biblical teaching of Dr. Michael Youssef. Leading the Way is here to equip and strengthen the church to stand strong and to advance the gospel in today's ever-changing world. Listen to Leading the Way with Dr. Michael Youssef at ltw.org/listen, and be sure to mention you heard about their program on the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast.
Continuing the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast, Neil, Roger, John, myself, Bob. Hey, John, let me ask you about this, though, the judicial system itself, because this is really a troubling time. As these Black Lives Matter and Antifa riots have gained the steam that they have over the last few years, it does seem like the concept of a fair trial is going out the window, because now what gets factored in is, okay, what is the effect that this is going to have on the country? I hate to say it, even the Supreme Court, I don't trust that the Supreme Court judges don't start factoring things like this in as well.
They already have,
cases,
Bob.
That they do. I know.
They've already done that.
Yeah,
so that's already happening.
I know. So what do we do? I mean, here we are in America now, where the concept of the judicial and even fair trials is gone, because now it doesn't matter the facts. It doesn't matter the guilt or innocence. It matters, are we going, you know, how many buildings are going to burn if we rule according to the facts? Well, then we got to factor that in. And there's a lot of people that think it's right to factor that in. They probably are debating that in the deliberations right now.
Which again, as we said earlier, not their role. That shouldn't be happening. And on top of that, Bob, you know, we also have entered into a day and age where there is no longer a jury of your peers. Because if you look at the makeup of the jury, they're definitely not the same age, not the same color, not the same gender as what Kyle is. So we've also entered into a day and age to where there is no more a jury of your peers. It's a jury of whoever the two lawyers decide to select on your behalf that are now going to be your jury to determine whether you're innocent or guilty moving forward.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what the answer to this. I wonder if this egg, John, can be unscrambled, because now, as long as the mob and Antifa and Black Lives Matter, and as long as they can intimidate juries from the streets, I'm not sure how anybody gets a fair trial in a highly publicized case, unless somehow, some way, conservatives and Republicans get enough of a backbone to seriously crack down on these riots and say enough is enough, and we get a tough Republican president in there with an AG who says, no, we're going to bring down the hammer. But I don't know. I hate to say it, but it's like we don't have fair trials in this country anymore, and it ought not be that way.
No, because all of these other things you just mentioned, even in this case, are now being factored into the outcome of somebody's life. You know, to Neil's point earlier, his life's going to be different from this point forward no matter what. Is it going to be different in a positive or negative way? The jury's now trying to decide that. And the reality is, to your point, Bob, he's not getting a fair shake. I mean, just the length of time this is taking, this, in my opinion, and I think a lot of other folks would look at it the same way, and if you don't, you're a total liberal and you're looking at this completely the wrong way through rose-colored glasses, because the reality is this was an open and shut case. These guys shouldn't have deliberated 10 minutes to determine what the outcome was.
Right, right. So they've got to be talking about all this other stuff.
They are. I guarantee, I would bet my life on it, that's what they're doing right now. In fact, I was talking last night that you almost have to wonder, is there some conversation going back to the judge saying, you know, this is the direction that we're headed. You probably ought to get the town ready for whatever uproar is going to come from our verdict. I know they're not really allowed to do that, but you got to believe some of that's going on.
Yeah, I would not be a bit surprised. Why, we're kind of winding down this podcast here, but I am curious about the conservative versus liberal side of this. I mean, what is it about conservative and liberal ideology that seems to be so clearly split in a case like this? I mean, why is it, Roger, I mean, what's your take? Why do you think conservatives are overwhelmingly on the side of acquittal and liberals are so overwhelmingly on the side of conviction? Is this as simple as, hey, we support Black Lives Matter protests or we don't? I mean, does it come down to that or what is it?
Well, I think that's a part of it. My hunch is that you've got a certain segment of the population that doesn't like guns, doesn't like anybody getting shot, doesn't like anything that has to do with bad things, you know, like that. And I say bad in air quotes. You know, they would not look at Kyle Rittenhouse's trial as anything other than, here's a white supremacist who had brought a gun to a knife fight and shot and killed three people. full stop. That's where they're going to stop. And, you know, I think it would be, I realize we're appreciating the rule of law and are frustrated with the fact that it doesn't look like it's being followed here. But understanding, too, there are parts of the population here who are looking around saying, well, shake hands for the rest of us. Because of the, you know, you can go back and see all sorts of inhumane treatment of people in courtrooms and miscarriages of justice going back 40, 50, 60, 70 years in this nation, even further. And that stain still hangs around for a lot of people. And so, good, bad, or otherwise, they're looking at this and saying, wow, he didn't get a fair trial? Tough. Shake hands with the rest of us. I mean, that's and it's an unfortunate reality here in the United States that this is the country that we find ourselves living in on the doorstep of 2022. I think that when you look at the gun narrative, the left has got to be cheering with the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse is getting all of the attention right now, so then Alec Baldwin doesn't have to feel so bad about himself. Yeah. I mean, the fact that the Hollywood hypocrisy when it comes to weaponry and the way they're used and the way they're charged, is there ever a reason for live ammo to be anywhere near a movie set or a television set? They virtue shame and virtue signal all day long about cigarettes. We get TV warnings now. You know, they'll use 7 and 8 letter words that we used to use in the locker room and we were afraid someone was going to hear us and suspend us. And that's all over regular network television now. But God forbid if someone lights up a Camel and next thing you know, it's all, there's a lucky strike warning here because the main character is about to pretend to smoke a cigarette. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. And so the fact that somebody died on a movie set because they got shot with a real gun that had a real, you know, round of ammunition in it, and a guy like Alec Baldwin's like, oh my gosh, what have I done? Well, what you did is you shot and killed somebody. That's what you did. You know, I don't know why you thought that you could control your own reality, that everything could be scripted so perfectly. But the reality is when you get to real life and you see what happens in real time, you can script a story like Kyle Rittenhouse's to go any way you want to. But in reality, this is what happened. When he was confronted with evil and people chasing after him and hurling insults and things like that, he reacted the way you would expect a 17-year-old with a rifle to react. I mean, I'm not saying that's good or bad, but, you know, this is what happens in real life, and we have to judge the facts for what they are. And for those of us who are used to justice being carried out properly and fairly, the fact that this mob rule mentality now has permeated the courts is, it's frustrating, it's demoralizing, but in some ways it's kind of a, well, welcome to the rest of the world. Now everybody's is justice like this, and it's not right. It makes me all the more grateful. Lisa and I were praying about this even this morning, that God's ways are just and true and right and fair, because we know there is ultimately a standard. And I think that's what infuriates all of us about a trial like this, that, like, to John's point, the jury should have been able to nail this one and not have to worry about, you know, being doxxed and having their name blasted everywhere, which, you know, right, will. If he's acquitted, you know that all 12 members of the jury, plus the alternates, all their names, pictures, ranks, phone numbers, they'll be all over the internet and people will start hassling them. I mean, we've got that kind of mob rule going on right now. But because we believe in a biblical worldview that says there is justice, there is fairness, there is righteousness in the eyes of God, in the only court that really matters, when we see the temporal world working this way, it's frustrating and it's maddening. And I totally get that, because it is. But it's a sin-corrupted system. I mean, it's never going to be perfect. And I guess all we could do is strive for as perfect as we can make it, but remind people, look, this court may not get the verdict right, but ultimately there is one judge who matters more than anything else. And if we don't get that verdict right standing before him on Judgment Day, none of this other stuff matters.
So true. So true. Neil, maybe you could give us a final thought to kind of put some icing on this whole thing as we wind down this episode.
Well, I actually want to go back to something that John Rush said earlier, and it's not in any way an attack on you, John. It's just something I want to pick up and take a little further. And it has to do with the question of, you know, you get what's coming to you, that this one individual was shot and killed. He had been a pedophile, and, you know, as a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, I can tell you that in my humanness, in my flesh, you get what's coming to you. And at some point you say, hey, you know, too bad. The world's a better place without you. But that's a human thought. And I just want to add that, you know, if we're going to look at this from God's perspective, as Roger was just talking about, the reality is that if all of us got what's coming to us, it would be eternal separation from God, because that's what each one of us deserve. Am I in any way saying that these people who came after Kyle Rittenhouse, you know, should be exonerated of all of their crimes and everything else. No, not at all. And neither should Kyle Rittenhouse if he committed any crimes. But I'm simply saying this, that God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And so I'm not trying to over-spiritualize. I'm just trying to say, you know, if we're concerned about Black Lives Matter and other people deciding that vigilante justice is the way to handle things, and so we'll loot, you know, stores and we'll burn down buildings and we'll destroy cities because we're going to get our way, you know, one way or another. We're going to take matters into our own hands. Then in the church, we have to be careful to not do the exact same thing and decide in advance before a court case even happens that Kyle Rittenhouse is a good guy because he's coming up against Black Lives Matter, because he dared to stand up. He's a good guy. We're on his team. Everything he does is right. I'm not campaigning for or against Rittenhouse by saying that. I'm just saying, in the body of Christ, we can't be the kind of people that jump to conclusions either. Jesus, you know, died to absolve us of our sin, to make it possible for us to know God. And I think whenever we consider these kinds of things, we ought to look at that, because I guarantee that the heart of God was broken when those two individuals died. And his heart is broken by the mistakes that all of us make. I pray that we get it right. And we do have a legal system in our country. We need to abide by the laws that are on the books, and a whole bunch of them have been disregarded in this case. There's people pushing agendas all over the place, but the reality is the truth is evident, and it's in the middle of this whole thing. And Jesus himself is the truth, and let's just pray that it gets revealed and that the right thing is done that ultimately brings him glory, so that we can really rally around it and say the right thing was done, no matter how I feel about it. And I think justice will be served because God is able.
Well, now, of course, John, let's have you have the last word now.
Well, I appreciate everything that Neil said, and I did say that, you know, if this was an individual that, you know, had repented, had given his life to Christ, even with his past sins, okay, you know, yeah, I'm in that forgiveness mode as well. But when he didn't, and he's actually there to cause, in my opinion, more havoc, and he actually did what he did to Kyle, and Kyle defended himself and killed the guy, I'm sorry. I don't have a lot of sympathy at that point in time. You've gone down the path of destruction, and it finally ended for you. And to answer your question a moment ago, Bob, as to why things are the way they are on both sides of the aisle, because the conservative, not just Christians, but conservatives believe in the rule of law. Liberals believe in emotion. And they work off of emotion. We work off of facts, evidence, and the rule of law.
All right, folks. This is one of the reasons why a lot of people really enjoying this podcast. We always appreciate you folks listening to this podcast as well. You can listen online at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and more. You can go to CrawfordMediaGroup.net. And Neil Boron of Neil Boron Live out of Buffalo, New York. Roger Marsh from The Bottom Line of People's Republic of California. John Rush, Rush to Reason out of Denver, Colorado. Myself, Bob Duco, The Bob Duco Show in Detroit. Guys, always great catching up with you. Thanks so much. Look forward to next week when we're going to be having a special Thanksgiving-themed podcast. So looking forward to next week, guys. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Bob. God bless.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, we'll see you. Thanks for listening, everybody. God bless.
This has been the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Download and subscribe to the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and more. Apple users can rate the podcast, and we'd appreciate your 5-star rating. National Crawford Roundtable Podcast returns with a new discussion each week. Be sure to watch for the notification on your podcast app. This has been a Crawford Media Group production.